trombonist Steve Turi with Rainbow People. He also plays the Shells and introduced it in a pretty grand way into his music. I'll find a piece that illustrates the beauty of the Shells. That's, you know, seashells. And he became known for that as well, pioneering the use of shells in his music. This is the first piece of his 14th album of the same title, Rainbow People, recorded in 2007. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're picking up from where we left off on this matter of what the heck is going on in this country. And we have to face some rather unpleasant reality. Reality number one being that in the end, we are responsible. We are responsible for the outcome. We are responsible for what happens. And we should get out of this notion that somebody else ought to fix it. We have to fix it ourselves. President Biden went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and made a speech. You can't down the guy. He's doing the best he can, realizing, of course, that he's on the receiving end of a lot of stuff, and then people stand there waiting to see what he will do about it. I'm taking a slightly different tack. He will do whatever the people compel him to do, and it is unfair, to say the least, that people all of a sudden should park all this stuff at his door, saying, here, you should fix this, we need a solution for that, and we need answers for the other. 100 years. I am referring now specifically to the Tulsa massacre. 100 years have gone by, and people are still waiting for some messiah to come in and make all well again and fix it. I say that that's the wrong approach. We were talking about this when we had to break, and so we're back and ready to continue from where we left off. But this is the message that I hope people get. It is not up to anybody else to fix things. Obviously, if this was a matter that went unsolved, unattended to for 100 years, don't try to impress me about how passionately you feel about it. What happened to the resolve of blacks to take charge of their own lives, of their own communities, and to the extent possible, I recognize the power, the ability to solve things was not at 100%. And the very nature of this crime, leveling more than 35 blocks of land and well-to-do people's lives, and the horror of it all. But Tulsa was not the only such attack on black communities. But we certainly exercised great patience, wouldn't you say? Is it patience or is it cowardice? Was 100 years how do we interpret that? Was that 100 years spent in deep thought, in covert action, planning to rebound? How do we interpret 100 years of nothing happening except talk? Is there a master plan that has been, that was fashioned over this 100 year period, that people had a lot of time to think, and so they used 100 years to think and to come up with some kind of a solution? No. It was just talk. And in some case, it wasn't even that. It was moving on to the next thing, ignoring what had happened, because they did not have the will to sit down and come up with a workable plan that would have honored the dead of 100 years ago appropriately. This is a source of ongoing frustration to me, where too often in the African American community, people are likely to respond to the emotionality of things, like, oh, it's 100 years since this has happened. No, you should now see it differently. By now, yes. It's 100 years of inaction. 100 years of nothing done. 100 years of nothing being accomplished. 100 years of no progress. All within that time, there were possibilities for solutions to address the problem, to come up with something that would have at least paid homage not only to the dead, but more than that, and I say more than that because it is also about how did you safeguard a possible future after the devastation? Did you even bother to do that? We take solace, it seems, in celebrating and commemorating these events at the appropriate anniversary, and we wax philosophic and we make speeches, we even cry. But the fact is, we produce nothing that has to do with how we assist in the transition to our next collective survival. Nothing. This happens over and over and over again, and I get more and more fed up with the uselessness of it all. Making these silly speeches, And you drag out a handkerchief from time to time and you block your tears because you're so overcome with grief. But 100 years have gone by and we still don't have a plan. We don't have even an excellent analysis. We don't have a historical document. That delineates, that says this is what happened. We don't have the recorded voices of people who went through it. We don't have a record that says this happened to our people in this area. We did not get everything done that we wanted to get done, but this much we have done. The same talk on the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Everybody is angry. Everybody is anti-racist. Everybody is all charged up. Nobody yet has been able to produce a plan that honors King the way he deserved to be honored and to secure those things that he had started, that they should continue and be successful. Because in the end, it was all about helping our community. Too much work. Too much work. We prefer instead on the appropriate anniversary date to make a big thing, to let the world see how we are suffering still, how much we miss this one and how much we miss that one. But there isn't very much in the way of evidence that there has been consistent application to the overall, the overarching issue at hand. How do we progress from here? Sure, Biden shows up and he makes a speech. And to give him credit, he's the first such president to make a speech reflecting these kinds of thoughts. But that's what he's supposed to do. That's what he should do. Still, we recognize that he's the first president to do it. But that doesn't put us any closer to making sense of or moving along with a plan of action that produces results from 100 years ago. What are we going to read, meet every 100 years and go through this? Is that the intention? Is that the plan? I would be so bold as to say that many people don't want to be involved in a plan like that. They don't want to contribute. They don't want to deal with it. They leave that to somebody else. And they walk around with their righteous anger, as if that solves a problem. We have to really come clean with ourselves. We are a people who mind the calendar in these last couple of years to keep in mind the anniversary of this death, that assassination, that bombing that killed off our people. We have no calendar, none, as to when we will solve problem A or problem B or problem C. That's not part of what we are considering. We are not taking care of business. We leave that to other people who have the time or who are patient enough. They're the same people who do the work all the time. Based on what we have been through collectively, one would think that we have way too many projects working at the same time. We have too many things happening. We can't keep track. Instead, we sit and wait to see if by the next anniversary there's something to report from somebody else's efforts that could help us. So in a sense, we insult ourselves. We insult those who made sacrifices for us. We won't get off our butts to do anything to advance a cause. We don't have that Garvey spirit. We don't have a recognition that this is something we must do as a people. We wait till other people who may or may not even know what they're doing, but they see that nothing is being done, and they make a creditable try. We, the vast majority of us, are sitting around waiting to see who, if anybody, shows up willing to do the work with sleeves rolled up. And we stand on the sidelines, we criticize, we say, well, they should have done this and they should have done that, but you do nothing. And I keep carping about this because I think 100 years is enough time to pass judgment. 100 years is enough time to pass judgment. You have done nothing in 100 years. Yet you have high hopes and expectations. Because now you say, well, the president ought to do it. Give it to him. He's president, and this happened under a different president, yes, but he's a president now. Give it to him. Give him this assignment to fix this. The time has long passed since we can derive any degree of moral superiority or comfort of passing the proverbial buck. You're either in or you're not. You're either with it or you're not. That's what we have to start doing now. You're not helping me personally when you make the right decision. You're helping you. You're helping all those who came before you. You're standing in their stead. You're present and accounted for where other people have decided to absent themselves. Yeah, let them show up. They'll do it. Do you know how many times I have found myself by myself into the wee hours of the morning trying to prepare something, putting some things together? And I, out of a sense of guilt, there are a few people who showed up to help. And my conscience would not let me allow them to stay. Not a minute later, I could see they were tired, exhausted. We all were. But something that the community should have taken pride in, the people who should have been present and accounted for, never showed up. Never showed up. And it was not unusual that the same faces would turn up every time there was something that needed to be organized. The same faces. They're freeloading. They're reaping the rewards of benefits they did not invest in and had no intentions of investing. I despise people like that. Why? Because we have so many examples of a whole different attitude within our own group. People who couldn't wait to get to work because it's about helping the children. It's about helping the elderly. It's about helping those of our community who desperately needed help. They showed up, ready to work. The vast majority sat by and took their own personal tour. Well, is it coming along? What does it look like? Would this succeed or not? Not to lend a hand, not to contribute, but in fact to be intentionally critical. And at the first chance they get, they're out the door. Oh, they forgot they had to go pick something up. Or they have something else to do. We have to end the cycle. It would be brutal. It will be brutal, but we have to do it. If we have to force people to confront their own contradictions, we'll have to do it. You're not giving money. You're not giving your time. You're not giving your talent. You're not giving your advice. You are constructively of no value to the forward thrust of our community. You should be ignored, set aside, moved aside. And this is the attitude that we have to stamp out of our community. I grew up in a little country, in a little town in a little country. My father and his friends, they were lodge brothers. the International Court of Foresters. And you should see what they looked like. They were just a ragtag crew. A ragtag crew. But those same men stepped forward and built us a school. They built us a place where we could come and sit down and have a meal, however modest it was. That's what they did. They raised money to buy the wood to build a latrine. Nobody had to ask them to do it. They simply asked themselves, how do we make this thing happen? What do we have to do? The women were cooking. Every child got fed. Every child was transferred from his or her mother's care to a care of somebody, the care of somebody. Make sure that the child eats, has something to drink. And by the end of the day, the last thing these women did was to drag you by the scruff of your neck to what we used to call a standpipe and wash your face. Because you dare not go home looking scruffy. You have to go home looking like somebody took care of you while you were here. See? These were people who were committed to an ideal. We don't have that anymore. We have people who are specialists, passing the buck, blaming somebody else, absenting themselves from battle. They are a shame and a disgrace to our community. And we ought to let them know that. We ought to let them know that. It's not like we are being taught new values. These are our values. These are our intrinsic values. And there are all kinds of evidence out there to support that. When Father Divine in Harlem says, we don't care what your religion is. You hungry, you come here and get something to eat. That was a solid vow. When Garvey said, we don't care whether you follow Garveyism or not, you come here, we will take care of you. Not just while you're here, we'll take care of you after you leave. We don't do that anymore because it's all about the self. It's about me and my and mine. And we have the nerve to stand like tourists observing the fray and pass judgment on what is not being done when we have absolutely no part in what is to be done. So I would like you, if you happen to be in the company of such individuals, let them understand what a disappointment they are to the spirit of overcoming as a community. What a traitor they are to the community spirit. We have no use for people like that. and let us recommit ourselves in whatever way we can, a meaningful way, to seeing to the whole. It's not just about me and my and mine. We must revive that spirit of community. It is the only way we shall all survive. We'll take this break and come back to your comments and questions. I did promise, because many people were not able to get through. But don't worry. Space will be made, and you will get to make your point. But we'll take this break right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And the number to call is 888-874-4888. I couldn't help myself. I was so angry. I had to work really hard to calm down with this focus being on Tulsa, the Tulsa race massacre of 100 years ago, and seeing how hesitant we are as a community about getting business done. 888-874-4888. And we start off with Ed from Queens. You're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon, Eutrice. How are you feeling today?
Well, you can hear me. You know how I am if you're hearing me.
I feel your anger. I feel your anger. I mean, I share it also. There is definitely a depth of community in the African-American experience. Referring to Tulsa, there were over 100 massacres at the time of Tulsa, anywhere from Wilmington, North Carolina to Rosewood. So the Tulsa was one of the outstanding ones, but there were over 100. As far as dealing with it, I really don't know. I've been involved in the movement specifically for reparations for quite some time. And even though little goals have been made, and even though a few years ago was a pipe dream, now it's getting serious consideration on the national scene, even though a lot of it I feel like it was lip service, still there is a prevailing sentiment towards it. I mean, in 2001, for example, a Chicago poll was taken, and in 2001, only 6% of white people were in agreement, only 4% of white people were in agreement that African Americans deserve reparations. The same poll was taken in 2019, and now it's up 16%. So, I mean, there are minor gains being made. We definitely need to unify to present a solid front and put forward some concrete goals and establishments to obtaining reparations, because it's old. It's a debt that needs to be paid. Reparative justice needs to be implemented, and the gaps of wealth and class need to be closed. I believe we're at a moment in time where we can make some real progress, because the COVID-19 situation has caused a lot of people to focus. And there have been some progressive moves made. But we got to understand, Roosevelt didn't give us the New Deal, or didn't give the country the New Deal, because he wanted to. Roosevelt was a conservative politician from a wealthy family. There was a prevailing force, a labor force, a socialist force, a civil rights force, that forced Roosevelt to make the changes that were necessary to improve the quality of life in this country. And unless that force forced Roosevelt to do it, he wouldn't have done it. And we don't have that force now. We don't have that organized ability to force Biden, to force this Democratic Party, to force this government monstrosity to do what is necessary to increase the quality of life. And we must be proactive, because this moment, like all moments, it's a point in time that will fade away. And if we don't act on this moment in time and take the momentum and use it, I think we're like I've said time and time again, we're at the beginning of the end. So I don't know, you know, I do what I can, where I can. I'm involved with ADOS. I'm involved with NCOBRA. You do what you can. But we definitely need to solidify this movement. We definitely need to reinstitute or even reinvent community, because a lot of what you said I agree with, but I don't think it's possible anymore because the social infrastructure isn't there. And we don't have time to rebuild it, so we have to work with what we've got if we want to see any type of meaningful progress or meaningful change in the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Ed, for getting us started today. Thank you for contributing. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Atrice. Thank you.
Hello.
For that opening. It was really beautiful. And even if you're angry, it's really good for others to hear that. You're a great orator. I just wanted to piggyback on some of the things you were saying, and I wanted to say that, you know I talked in this show in such cynical ways about President Biden and didn't think that he would be able to do anything. But I also said this, too, that he might just do it because everyone, he wants to go out as a hero. I think he really does. But I also have to say yesterday that what I saw in him, I thought was genuine. And I actually think that he's probably the best politician that he could be at this point in his life, because he is actively learning and caring about the things he's seeing. I think he was genuine yesterday. And I think that it was actually a very good beginning, and it was a very good validation to those who lost members, for everybody. Because this isn't really just a black problem. It's a black and white problem. And mm-hmm. we have to solve it on both sides. And so acknowledgement is the first step in healing. But white people have to be able to do their part in this. And to me, that's reparations. And I heard somebody this morning speaking about the same guy talking on BAI about the population and the percentage of population of blacks in this country. Now, I really don't think he was right. I think he said it was 13% of our country was black. I think it's more like 18%. And he said there was about 40 million blacks living in this country. I think it's higher than that. But I started to look at those numbers and I thought, you know, if you gave everybody $1 million, every black family $1 million, that would be a good chunk of change. And it would be very good for them because it would help the healing process, but it would also be good for everyone else too, because if you got $1 million, you could really do something with that. If you're a farmer and you got $1 million, if you're a black farmer and you got $1 million and you drove that into your business, you could really do some good business, but you would also be helping the economy. You would be helping everything else that makes the machine work. So it's almost like, instead of giving like stimulus checks, kind of sort of aimlessly doing these stimulus checks, you could give $40 million away. And $40 million in this day and age is really not anything. Because when you have people like Jeff Bezos, who is, you know, I think he's a billionaire of $64 billion, and I see that on a regular basis, this government doesn't just dole out million-dollar checks anymore. I mean, the budget for the School Construction Authority here in New York in 1999 was $6 billion. That was just for 5 years. My point is, today, it's not that much money for the United States to absorb. But it would do a great thing to help people who have been suffering for years. It would validate the atrocities that have happened to them, and it would help everyone. It would help everyone in our country to have people doing better and contributing to this economy, if you want to look at it that way. I just also wanted to say this, too, about jumping in and getting involved. You know, I was talking to somebody this morning who was kind of yelling at me about I was running for the public advocate, and he wanted me to do something, and then he just wanted to leave it at my doorstep, and he would walk away and go back, but he brought it to my attention, and so I was supposed to run with it. But the thing is that when I ran for council here in East Harlem, there's 150,000 people. One person cannot simply do every individual's work for them. You as constituents, I, me, you, we all have skin in the game. And you're so right. Nobody's going to do anything you want them to do unless you step up to the plate and you are the squeaky wheel. And the squeaky wheel does get the oil. Now, the other side of the coin today is that the other squeaky wheel squeaks it with money, tons and tons of money. All we have is our mouths, our hands, and our bodies. But we have made some inroads here. And I am not discouraged by what I'm seeing. Not everything the Biden campaign is doing is perfect, but, you know, what is. But I am certainly impressed that it has been 100 years and not one person did anything. Not one president has ever stood up and taken this on and spoke about it publicly, acknowledged it, and treated it with dignity and respect. I'd also say one last thing to the people in the audience, and Ed mentioned this, that there have been a lot of atrocities like this, but the most recent one was MOVE in Philadelphia. And I was talking on Ralph Pointer's show last night about this, that would we today talk about the people who were bombed by the police department of Philadelphia? Would we talk about them with the same respect that we were talking about the people from Tulsa? And I think not, because the people who were in Tulsa had money. And that changed everything. That gave them dignity and respect. But, you know, the people in Philadelphia and the MOVE group, they didn't come to the table with money. They had ideals. And their ideals were of living in a better planet. And they were demonstrating it through their lifestyle. Now, whether you agree with that or not, but it is something to think about, that we need to not just cozy up to people that have the money and give them the respect and make sure we acknowledge them, but the others who have suffered while trying in a very big way to make change, to make significant change. And I believe the people in the MOVE group were.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your contribution today. Henry from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Patrice, how's it going?
Okay, Henry, how you doing?
All right, hanging in there. It's interesting what you were talking about earlier in regards to the building of community, because the problem that we have is when you're building a community, you're taking risk joining that community. You're taking risk helping out that community. And I just don't think enough of us are ready to take that risk. But right now, we just have to gather as many people as we can who are willing to sacrifice, you know, their lives or livelihoods to help build this community. So when you know, like I'm part of an organization that does neighborhood watches, and this is in Chicago, and people are, you know, criticizing us like, well, wow, why don't, you know, you guys are going to get shot, or you guys are going to get, you know, you guys are in the middle of danger and such and such and such and such. But you know what? We don't care, because this is something that needs to be done. Whether me or one of my colleagues get shot, that's a risk that we all understand that we all going to take. But the whole point of the matter is to reduce and make sure that our people in our streets are safe, and particularly the women and children. So this mentality of, well, we can't do that because somebody might get shot, we have to throw that away. And this is the mentality that we have to have more and more. And I understand that majority of the collective is not ready to take those risks. And also, too, people have to figure out where they fit in this particular, you know, in this particular building of community. You don't necessarily have to go out there and be neighborhood watch. You know, there's a lot of other things that you can do. I think you mentioned, you know, contributing some time, doing something, you know, maybe giving some money, whatever. But also, too, those come with risk as well. I know one thing, I write articles for certain for certain magazines, and I know if there's somebody who is associated with me, who provides me some kind of monetary income, they'll probably look at it and be like, well, we can't give you no money anymore. But you know what? I'm willing to take that risk. to express my truth and to express the truth that is going on with our people. And also, too, you were yesterday, I wanted to get on talk about, you know, you were talking about how 100 years go by and nothing is done. And I think the problem with that, too, is controlling of the narrative is something that we as a people need to take, you know, we need to take that by the wheel. Most of the listeners, including myself, have just realized what has happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the last 30 years outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, you know, that to me, that's a shame. But then also, too, I was listening to an interview with Neely Fuller, and he grew up in a town right outside of Oklahoma. I think he was born a couple of years after that incident. And he said throughout the early part of his childhood and adult years, they never talked about it. And so when you don't talk about it, nothing basically gets done. And then the narrative, like I said, is controlled by the people who have caused the devastation. Because I remember seeing it as the Tulsa, Oklahoma race riots. And it was specifically labeled as a riot because the insurance people would not pay the black residents who were victims of that massacre, as they call it now, the insurance money because of the fact that it was a riot. So there was an intentional labeling of a riot, you know, for the first 50-something years of that particular incident. So we need to control the narrative on these stories and understand what type of damages have been wrought to these victims. Here in Chicago, there were people who knew about the John Birch case 10 years before he even got convicted. And so when you don't know, you know, it's like you get a hold of it, and already there's been 50 victims of that whole particular case. So we got to uncover all of this stuff and understand what our people have been through so we can control this narrative and also demand proper recompense for these damages.
Thank you, Henry, for your opinion today. Gene from Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You know, I too followed the president and paid attention to his speech and the things that he was saying. And I was impressed that he actually stepped out and said something because many before him, including President Obama, have said nothing. And so I'm impressed by that, and I'm pleased that he had something to say. However, it puzzles me that this sort of activity that happened in Tulsa, that happened in Rosewood, Florida, that happened in North Carolina, that happened in Skokie, Illinois, all across the country. We have seen very clear photographs of people conducting hangings, people conducting lynchings, people pulling detainees out of a jail to lynch them on the courthouse steps. There has never been any follow-up on the pictures in the newspaper. Who are these people? Did they turn out to be a city council person? A judge, the sheriff? What is it that has prevented any sort of investigation, any sort of pursuit of justice with this evidence that exists presently? And again, there's no statute of limitations on murder. And so you talk about a plan and the 100 years that have passed, I haven't been able to get an answer on that particular question. And I've had an opportunity to ask some rather prominent people this very question, and nobody wants to answer it for me. And so I'd just like to place that on the table today for a discussion here with Lead Stories, just to see what folks think about that.
Okay. Thank you so much for contributing today.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our program today, but not to the end of our discussion. This is a vital discussion because when we listen to the different takes that people have, and they're all valid, they all make sense, but at some point we have to winnow it down. If we were to select the top three or four things that we must do and must achieve now, what would those things be? Who would step forward to say, well, I will be a part of that? For example, we talked about plans. Plans. Who's making plans? Simple things. At least they may sound simple, but you have no idea how important it is, how secure a mother feels when she sees her child coming home, being brought home by a neighborhood friend. Safe. Or that your child, you may not have been able to put something in a bag and say, okay, this is your lunch, but your child has been fed. Nobody would see your child go hungry. These are the things we have to return to, because they are an expression of community. So we leave it there for today. I thank you all for listening and for contributing, and we return to each other again tomorrow to continue the conversation. Bye-bye.